Okay. Actually, Angela mentioned I'm from SLAC. SLAC is the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, which is the high-energy physics lab that's associated with Stanford University. We were actually the first website in the U.S. in 1991, the fifth in the world. And since then, you know, certainly the web has taken over my life as well as a lot of other people's. I want to thank you for having me here. It's a lot of fun to come back to Hong Kong. And when Angela asked me, you know, what I wanted to talk about, and I gave her the title of Universal Web Accessibility, a few minutes after I gave her that title, I thought about it, and I thought to myself, you know, well, would I go to a talk that had the word universal in the title? Wouldn't I be a bit skeptical and think that either it was philosophical, religious, or else the speaker was just plain pretentious? But actually, I think you're going to see why this particular title is appropriate, especially if some of you have some interest or have done some research in the general area of what web accessibility means. The first thing I want to say, and accessibility is just a case, is that when you look at a lot of the technologies associated with the web, it's sort of easy to understand that the web is a victim. The web is a victim of its own success, in the sense that no one really had any idea of how fast it would grow. No one really had any idea of the wide range of applications, the ways in which it would be used. Nobody had any real idea about the wide variety of users that would be using the web. And one other thing, certainly, is that since it was a brand new phenomena and a brand new medium, most people really didn't have any idea about how to create content for it, how to author for it. So it's a victim of its own success in a lot of ways, and I think accessibility is one of them. And it's one of those areas that perhaps that the web is only right now attempting to catch up with, to address some of the things that were perhaps inherently lacking in its original design. Now, we talked about the fact that you know, we didn't really have any idea about the kinds of people that would be using the web. One of the groups of people that it became immediately obvious to were people that were disabled. So the classical sort of definition that a lot of people think about when they hear the term web accessibility is, how can I create websites? How can I create web pages that are accessible to the handicapped? And in particular, it became an initiative of the World Wide Web Consortium, of which Tim Berners-Lee is the director, that addressing the issue of access to web content by disabled people should be a major priority. Okay? And as a result, the W3C initiated what's called WAI, the Web Accessibility Initiative, which, once again, as I said, began primarily to address the issues of content access by disabled people. But certainly, I think now that we can see, we are going to see, that the definition of access has become a lot further. And that's why I make the reference to universal accessibility. Basically, though, when we talk about sort of the limited definition of accessible of people that are affected by websites that are not accessible, it has been estimated by Microsoft, none other than Microsoft, that 20% of Americans have some kind of disability. And there's no reason to believe that that kind of statistic is not really extensible to other parts of the world. And this doesn't always apply to sort of the obvious ways that we think about disabilities, that we obviously think about individuals who are blind, who are deaf, who have other physical type of disabilities, but also can apply more commonly in this case, to people who are colorblind, people who have problems, you know, differentiating certain pairs of colors, or people who have reading disorders, and so consequently might not be able to address some of the cognitive issues that are associated with the use of websites. And of course, one that I'm becoming more and more aware of are the problems that sort of are associated with individuals as they get older. Okay? So accessibility can also include these categories or these genres or these groups of people that do in fact sort of fall outside our conventional concept of what disabled means. One of the main attentions that the WAI initiated in the States, and certainly the growth of the web initiated in the States, was the interest of the federal government, especially with respect to the Americans with Disabilities Act. And in 1998, Congress amended this act to have what is called Section 508. And Section 508 basically says that inaccessible technology, in this case they're not just talking about the web, that inaccessible technology actually makes disabled individuals second-class citizens. It basically interferes with their ability to obtain information, it interferes with their ability to use information, and in some cases, employees that have disabilities who depend on some of these electronic means, you know, are in fact at a disadvantage, and that their access should be comparable to the access of those employees who do not have disabilities. So certainly, passing this particular act, Section 508, caused a great deal of activity or interest in the states about what does accessibility mean? How can we address accessibility? How can we measure accessibility? Okay? It was eliminated, I'm sorry, Section 508 was enacted to eliminate these barriers, we said, in information technology. But it wasn't, as I said, limited only to the web. You say that it's limited to computing, software, any sort of telecommunication, any sort of multimedia, and even office equipment come under the category of accessible under Section 508. Okay, so one of the ways that the W3C addressed this issue, especially in this case, obviously, about web-based content or internet-based content, I said was to create the WAI, and the WAI issued what are called the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. And these guidelines are intended to be instructions or guidelines that web designers can follow to make their websites accessible. But to make their websites accessible, not necessarily, once again, limited to our small definition of what disabled means, our small definition about what accessibility means. Okay, and so we're going to talk about some of these particular issues in the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines and some of the impacts that they might have. For example, one of the common ways that web designers typically think about making their websites accessible is by including the alt tag for images. The alt tag for images basically says, okay, that with an image, it means that if, for a reason or another, someone is using a non-graphical browser and they can't see the image, or if for some reason or other they have images turned off in their browser, or if for some reason or another they can't support a particular type of image, if they're blind or whatever, and image is provided by provides information, that there's an alternative way that that same information can be provided. And that's what the alt tag does. But it also does a lot of other interesting things. For example, alt is one of the few mechanisms by which indexers or robots for search engines can actually find out something about an image. Because a robot who's doing a search, say, for Google, can't really look, is not really looking at the page, and so therefore can only identify the content contained in an image by means of what the designer might have put in the alt tag. Okay? Now that's one of the examples. A couple of the other general examples that I have listed here, and I can, you know, defer to Roger. I probably have just about as much text on my slides, but maybe fewer points. So I somehow try to categorize this by saying I don't have as many bullets, but I might have just as much text. Okay? Is addressing the issue for color, as we said, especially when color relays important information. So this is looking at color not just as a medium of design, not just to make something look pretty or interesting, but color can also be an effective way of relaying information. Okay? Certain things about including captions. Once again, an easy way of recognizing the importance of this particular guideline is that captions can enable, once again, things like globalization, access to information for people that might be blind, whereas then a reading browser can read the caption since the individual cannot see the image. So I think that some of these particular principles you can really identify with in terms of how they're applicable, in particular how they are applicable to access to web information by individuals that have handicaps. But one of the ways, one of my goals in this particular talk is also to say how these guidelines are applicable to other forms of accessibility, not just the issue of accessibility for the handicapped. And that's why I referred in that case to universal accessibility. Okay, now before I get to that, back to these WCAG, back to these web content accessibility guidelines. Now certainly since these were published by the W3C, a number of very interesting tools that help designers, that help website maintainers judge how accessible their websites are. So in other words, how their websites might be used by individuals that have handicaps or by some of the other mechanisms that I'm going to put under the umbrella of universal accessibility. Perhaps the best known of these tools is one called Bobby, which was originally developed by CAST. This is the Center for Assistive Technology. Now, I mention Bobby simply because it's very easy to use. You just go to their website, you type in a URL, and it will generate a report for you that tells you how well your website adheres to the W3C guidelines. Okay. Now, of course, I would never use a website that I was responsible for because I'm the one who's giving this talk, and of course, all my websites should be accessible. Right? So what I chose was the HKU website. So I gave the HKU website to Bobby and I said, judge whether or not the HKU website is an accessible website. And guess what? The HKU website does not meet the WCAG criteria. Okay? Now, there's certain levels, for example, in these criteria, priority ones are the most important. Priority ones are the ones that say you gotta fix them now. Priority 2 and priority have lesser importance. But you can see in this particular case, it is saying that HKU.HK, you know, does in fact have some serious accessibility. Okay? That's all I'm going to say in that, but I'm not going to make any judgments about. But one, for example, just we said, is an issue about its use of color. On this page to understand exactly what those issues were. The important thing, as I said here, is that we're seeing or tools that are built into web design tools that incorporate the guidelines. Okay, now I want to define what, you know, how does this differ from my initial definition of accessibility. Well, instead of just saying web content to be fully addressable, fully accessible, I'm saying instead that I want a that anyone, not just the disabled. So this is implying, hey, people might be looking at not just people. Anyone or anything, technology, anything that can send HTTP, okay, should be able to visit or any site and get a full and complete that they're not restricted any way technology that they're using to address that site. Further, it says not only then would this person acquire content, but if that site is interactive, this person or this agent would have access to. This is what I refer to as universal accessibility. It includes our definition of individuals, but it also goes a lot further. But that question that we said that we didn't know the range of ways that people would be using the web. We didn't know the techniques that they would be being used, or that any that were being used or would be used given the universal accessibility is looking at, whereas initially when we designed web designed them for maybe just these guys, but now given the developments in the world accessed by the handicap, this is a web and blind. Okay. Cell phones, web TV, PDAs, automobiles. Google is an example, when you say of search engines, Google is an example of a non-human user of a website. So when we talked about access to website by agents, we certainly are talking then about search engines. And this becomes even more important when we talk about or we realize the importance of search in people's use of the web. And then, of course, here I've included our web-enabled toaster. This past weekend, I went to this Integer exhibit over near the Citic Tower. And in this particular exhibit, all of the appliances in the kitchen are on the web. Okay? So when you're coming home from work, you can use your Palm Pilot to access the web to turn on your microwave oven. Okay? So your microwave oven or your toaster is one of these agents that has to have accessibility, has to be able to interact with these sites. Okay? So what does universal accessibility mean? Well, some of you may remember in the earlier days of the web, sometimes you'd see a page that said, this page best viewed with Netscape 3.0. This is back in the day, certainly, when they had their own markup. Or this page best viewed with Internet Explorer 2.0. The idea of universal accessibility says this page best viewed with any browser. In particular, any browser, any system, any time. And this supposedly, according to a colleague of mine, says the same thing in Chinese.
I hope I wasn't fooled here. I didn't authenticate it.
So I hope that at least says
something that is somewhat comparable.
Doesn't, Angela?
That's for system, not for any time.
But it basically says, it says well, any
browser.
Viewed by any browser. Okay,
yes. Best viewed with any browser. Okay.
So this is what my definition of universal accessibility means. Now,
why do we care about this?
Let's look at really now the scope
of what we would perceive
universal accessibility as being. And in one way, we can see, given the way that the web has evolved,
one way that we believe that universal accessibility can do is to help increase market share and audience reach.
So not only does it deal with or address
issues of usability for disabled individuals,
but it also supports a number of other
issues, things such as low literacy levels.
We're going to talk a bit about repurposing in a minute.
It adds support for internationalization.
Pages that are in different languages,
pages
that have different cultural attributes that might
be appropriate for their particular purpose.
It also talks about assisting access for low bandwidth users. Do we consider in the design of our website
that low bandwidth users
are second class citizens? Okay?
If we're running an e-commerce site,
if someone is using dial-up to get access to our site, do we don't want their money because they're using dial-up?
Okay.
I think not. So if, in fact, we can provide the best experience for them, given the limitations of their access,
then that,
too, can be addressed under the umbrella
of universal access.
We will see that it can improve efficiency. Certainly because of the way or the techniques,
which we're going to address in a second,
of accomplishing universal accessibility,
it makes web content
more maintainable. It makes
the operation of web
servers more efficient.
That's because it can address server
load by repurposing. It can address issues of server
bandwidth, like we mentioned earlier.
On a larger and global sense,
we can say that
adopting or believing in universal accessibility demonstrates
our social responsibility.
We're not just in this to make money. Okay?
We are, in fact,
once again, trying to take the spirit of the web, which in fact is to provide content, you know, to as many people as we possibly can. And then, of course, back to ADA in Section 508, it could reduce our legal liability because now organizations in the United States that get money from the federal government, such as the lab that I work for, have to demonstrate that electronically accessed materials, such as via the web, you know, is in fact equally accessible for all employees. Otherwise, they're in jeopardy of losing federal funding.
Okay.
So, in fact, it could reduce someone's legal liability.
Okay. Here's a table.
Here's a table, basically, of how those checkpoints in the web accessibility guidelines address some of those particular issues.
This is going to be online,
so I'm not going to really go over these things point by point. But for example,
you know, one of the things that we said
is, are we going to mention, is the use of metadata. Metadata is a critical element
in web accessibility.
Okay? And anything that we can do in terms of defining the contents of our pages, defining the relationships in our pages, being able to use these relationships throughout the web, even between documents, certainly is going to increase the usability of the web, and in this particular column, make the web a lot easier,
say, for search engines.
A lot easier than to identify content. So we can say that there are market share, definite market share benefits to adopting the guidelines
of the W3C
for accessibility. Once again, these were developed not just for
disabled individuals,
but I would contend that these particular issues also apply or address other
issues when we under the
our definition of universal accessibility. These other issues that we might mention
here are the technical efficiency
issues, where we mentioned about the fact of dealing with bandwidth issues
or dealing with server load issues.
For example, how each of those particular checkpoints can be addressed
by adopting some of these guidelines.
Okay?
Now, one thing I wanted to say
about, especially that previous slide, my definition of universal accessibility was talking about, you know, the wide breadth of devices by which individuals might be able to obtain content from the web. And that's what's called repurposing. One of the key parts of designing an accessible website, and this is something that was once again lacking in the original definition of the web, and certainly has now come forward in the technology, is separating
content from presentation.
Okay? And you'll be able to see, for example, how this very important difference of defining the kind of
defining what you put on the web
can have dramatic effects on the accessibility of that what you put. Okay? So let's make a few definitions here.
Content is what you say.
Content is what you're providing. Presentation is how you present it. Okay? That said, we can say that for a particular site, content is invariant. We are developing, say, a website that provides information about courses at HKU. However, the presentation is variable.
What that means is
that we want that information that we have presented, that we have created, to be capable of being presented in a wide variety of ways, in case somebody looks at it on their mobile phone, or in case somebody looks at it
from their PDA.
Okay. We don't want any of that information to be lost because of the device in which they are viewing that content. And so repurposing is matching content to presentation. Okay? And the tools for repurposing are available right now. So for example, when a web server gets an HTTP request from a client, from a web client,
it knows what that client is.
It knows whether or not it's IE5. Okay? So the server is, in fact, have information about the client at some level that then it would be able to use in order to repurpose or provide content that was appropriate for that client. So these are not tools that are hypothetical. You know, these are tools and they are capabilities that actually exist now. Now, the whole scenario of repurposing really looks something like this with some of the existing tools. I didn't want to get terribly technical in this, but I think you understand the idea. In this particular chart, don't look at this chart and think client-server, because this is not client-server. But it's the distinction that we were making a few minutes ago about content and presentation. Right? So at this side is our emphasis on content. All right? Now, for repurposing vis-a-vis content, it says one of the main things that we have to do is that we have to provide information about that content. In other words, we have to provide metadata. There has to be a metadata level about that content that enables us really to accomplish our goal, you know, when we're talking about any kind of repurposing. An existing technology called RDF, Resource Description Format, really addresses this. This is a lot more than just the metadata that you might see in meta statements in HTML. Because what RDF does is it talks about relationships between data. You know, for example, you know, imagine whether or not you could now go to a search engine and say, show me papers that were written by Roger Clark and Fred Castro before April 27th, 1990, including the word RDF. Okay? Very complex relationships can be expressed here in this metadata description of content. Okay? We're not seeing RDF adopted a lot right now because there hasn't been the demand for it. It's difficult to accomplish. And search engine manufacturers like Inktomi, they aren't going to do it unless they're sure that people are going to use it because it's difficult to accomplish. It also makes metadata description a far more important part of website authoring than it ever has been before. Because it's basically telling the author of a website, not only think about the content that you're going to provide, but also spend a lot of time thinking about the relationships in that content that can be appropriate in its repurposing. Okay. What we next see in this particular diagram are what I would refer to as user profiles. Personalization of content. In this case, you're not really talking necessarily about users, so it's use profile. But it's the ways in which the content might be used. For example, one thing that we talked about, one of the elements of universal accessibility that we wanted was interactivity. Okay? So we've got to be able to understand how people might be able to use that content or what the requirements on its usage are. Okay, now on the presentation side, okay, a lot of repurposing, as I said, is built on existing technologies such as cascading style sheets, extensible style sheets like SSL, XSL, XHTML, and XML. Okay, because once again, those are technologies that allow us to repurpose or redefine content based on the kind of use that they're going to be getting, you know, such that in fact we realize that this request for this content is coming from a Nokia mobile phone. And so consequently we have an XSL spreadsheet, XSL style sheet that says these are the characteristics of this mobile phone vis-a-vis displayable space, vis-a-vis available fonts, vis-a-vis color, that would then optimize the presentation for that content on that device. And in doing so, then build an appropriate interface for that device that would be applicable to a particular user. Once again, in this particular model, no user is going to presumably be at a disadvantage, be they disabled or otherwise, because of the device that they're going to be using. All right? Now, these can serve very noble purposes. We talked about some of the market advantages. We talked about the technical advantages. We talked about the social responsibility that might come in designing accessible websites. But if you look at these guidelines, I think the underlying message for web accessibility and universal web accessibility is accessible design is not only good design, because it's making you think about what you're creating, but it's also good sense. Thank you. Comments, questions, and I want everybody to take what I said.